is a presentation, it's a review of Draft Amendment 1 to the Consolidated Highly Migratory Species Fishery Management Plan, Essential Fish Habitat. Chris, if you want to take the table, introduce yourself and guide us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Rilling. I'm with the Highly Migratory Species Management Division in Silver Spring, Maryland. I'm also here with Pete Cooper. He's also with our division. You all may recognize him. He used to work up here in the Northeast Regional Office and then more recently at the New England Aquarium. We're really happy to have him down in Silver Spring. Pete and I are going to be here tonight for a more extended public hearing and public comment session for the draft amendment. So this presentation is a shortened version. If you're interested, we have a lot more detail that we can present this evening. As the chairman mentioned, this is the Draft Amendment 1 to the Consolidated HMS Fishery Management Plan for Essential Fish Habitat. Let's see if I can get this to work. We are not proposing any regulatory measures under this Essential Fish Habitat Amendment. We're simply updating our EFH boundaries, proposing a new habitat area of particular concern for bluefin tuna in the Gulf of Mexico, and we've analyzed fishing impacts on EFH in this amendment as well. But we are not proposing any measures to minimize fishing impacts, so it is, in effect, not a regulatory action. If we consider the requirements under the Magnuson-Stevens Act from 1996, they are to identify and describe essential fish habitat, minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects on EFH caused by fishing activities, identify other actions to encourage the conservation and enhancement of EFH, and then in the Magnuson Act, it determined that the Secretary should set forth a schedule and timeline for amending EFH. The EFH regulations that were published in 2002 provided a little more guidance on what is required of fishery management plans. They include identification of EFH for each species and life stage. Also, identification of habitat areas of particular concern, identifying fishing and non-fishing activities that may adversely affect EFH, minimize fishing impacts that are more than minimal and not temporary. And the EFH regulations also spelled out the review of EFH information, which should occur at least once every 5 years. For the current amendment, the timeline looks like this. We published the notice of intent to amend our EFH boundaries in November of 2006. We held scoping meetings in March and October of 2007 in conjunction with our Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel meetings. We published a pre-draft in October 2007, followed by a notice of availability of the draft EIS, which published in September of this year. We have the notice of availability out front. I don't know if it was included in your materials. I think you all only have the presentation. The 60-day comment period was just extended to December 12th, primarily because we are consulting with all the councils and we're trying to fit in with council schedules and agendas and that sort of thing, so we had to extend the timeline to get to all the councils. I mean, we're expecting to finalize the EIS in the summer of next year. I keep turning that off. In terms of the history of EFH for highly migratory species, we first identified EFH, including descriptions and maps for each of the species and life stages in the 1999 Fishery Management Plan for Atlantic Tunas, Swordfish, and Sharks. And then as well, we did the essential fish habitat descriptions for billfish in Amendment 1 to the Highly Migratory Species Billfish Plan in 1999 also. We identified several HAPCs for sandbar sharks. Those areas will still remain in effect in the current amendment. In 2003, we published Amendment 1 to the HMS FMP, and that updated essential fish habitat for 5 shark species, sandbar, blacktip, dusky, nurse, and finetooth. At that time, we didn't have sufficient information to update EFH for all the remaining species. That leads us to the Consolidated Atlantic HMS FMP, which was published in 2006. We consider that essentially phase one of our 5-year EFH update. In that amendment, All state, federal, non-governmental data were mapped and published in the amendment on hard copy maps, but we didn't propose any changes to EFH at that time. It was simply a compilation of all the new data that had been accumulated since the 99 FMP when we originally identified EFH. We also described in depth all the fishing gear impacts that could potentially affect EFH, both non-federal and federal gears. And that gets us to this point. We're currently in draft amendment one to the consolidated HMS FMP. This amendment considers EFH for all Atlantic HMS, which includes tunas, swordfish, billfish, and all of the shark species. We've updated the EFH using a geographic information system to map each species and life stage. As I mentioned, we're proposing a HAPC for bluefin tuna spawning areas in the Gulf of Mexico. And we've also analyzed fishing and non-fishing impacts on EFH. The hard copy documents, by the way, are available from us. We don't have copies with us, but you can obtain those from us if you'd like, and we can also send you a CD copy of the document. I believe the council may have that already. In terms of the alternatives for identifying and describing essential fish habitat, alternative one is the no-action alternative to maintain the current boundaries. And then alternative two and all of the following alternatives relied on the following data sources. We used the Northeast and Southeast Longline Survey data, Pelagic Observer Program data, Shark Bottom Longline Observer Program data, and then data from the Cooperative Shark Tagging Program run through the Northeast Fisheries Science Center Apex Predators Program, as well as data on billfish, swordfish, and other marlins through the Cooperative Tagging Center run through Miami. In addition, we have a host of individual information from researchers who are conducting EFH studies on highly migratory species. One of those in particular is the what we're calling a synthesis document of shark nursery habitat. It's called Nursery Areas for Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico for Shark Species. It was published by the American Fisheries Society in December of last year. Cami McCandless and Dr. Nancy Kohler in the Northeast Science Center were instrumental in getting that published. We relied on that to a great deal for identifying EFH areas for sharks. So when I'm describing these alternatives, all of those data sets went into the analysis for these. Some of these are also very long-term data sets. The Cooperative Tagging Center, for instance, goes back into the 1950s. We use data up through 2006. Similar with the Cooperative Shark Tagging Program, that program has been in existence for many, many years. Some of those data points go back to the 1950s as well. Alternative two, to establish new EFH boundaries based on the highest concentration of a particular species by selecting high count cells is the approach we used in Amendment 1 to update EFH for the five shark species that I listed. In this approach, again, using geographic information system, we merged all of the points that we had for that species into a 10 by 10 minute grid and created a scale to reflect the number of points within that grid. And then we selected the high count cells to delineate the new EFH boundaries. Alternative three, which is the preferred alternative, establishes new EFH boundaries based on what we're referring to as the 95% probability boundary. In this alternative, individual data points are mapped and the probability boundaries based on those data points are generated. So in essence, the 95% probability boundary includes on average 95% of the data points for each species and life stage. We believe that this approach provides a standardized, reproducible, and predictable method for establishing EFH boundaries. In addition to the 95% boundary, we did map and analyze some of the lower probability boundaries, including the 70, 80, and 90% boundaries. Copies of those maps with the resulting boundaries can be located in the hard copy of the DEIS, but actually I think the preferable means to review the data would be to look at some of the maps that we've created using GIS and exported into Adobe, and those are available on the site there that I gave you the link for. The Adobe PDF maps have the advantage of being able to turn on and off various layers so that you can examine exactly what is being proposed with the 95% probability boundary. It also allows you to see the current existing boundaries as well as the points that were used to generate those boundaries. In addition to that, we have a lot of other environmental data loaded into those maps, in particular bathymetry boundaries, because in many instances when we are identifying our EFH boundaries, we will use the edge of a contour line perhaps, or in many cases the edge of the EEZ, to clip that boundary. So you can turn those layers on and off using the Adobe PDF maps. And then that third link on the bottom of this slide is a new internet mapping program that we developed specifically for this EFH amendment. And here's just a slide shot of the internet mapping site that I gave you the link to. This is actually, in my view, the preferred method of looking at what's currently being proposed and comparing that, for instance, to the existing EFH areas. You can, by selecting the species in the upper left, select the life stage, and then turn on and off various probability boundaries as well as the current EFH boundaries to get a real sense of what we're proposing in terms of changes to some of these boundaries. You can also turn on and off some of the bathymetry lines, as I mentioned, again, to see how some of the boundaries may have been clipped along certain contour lines. You may notice that we have a 95% probability boundary as well as what we're referring to as a preferred alternative. The preferred alternative, when you're using this internet mapping site, is simply the 95% probability boundary, which may have been edited in some way manually, either by clipping it along the EEZ, because we cannot identify EFH outside of the EEZ, or we may have clipped it along the shoreline or along certain coastal features like bays and estuaries. So this site, I really recommend people visit it, and it's an excellent tool for reviewing the current boundaries and what we're proposing. We're really pleased to have this tool available, especially given the number of species. We have 45 species in all that we manage. In many cases, two or three life stages, depending on whether we had information. For instance, for some of the neonate young of the year sharks, we might have three life stages for some of the sharks. It's a lot of mapping that went into this, and I believe this tool here really kind of simplifies and condenses all that information to where it's really usable and available to you all and to the public. We did consider two additional alternatives for identifying EFH. These aren't included on the mapping site. These were considered but not further analyzed. They are simply broader alternatives that would have established, in the case of alternative four, new EFH boundaries using all the points or cells where species are present. And alternative five would establish new EFH boundaries using the entire range of distribution for each species and life stage. We didn't consider these any further because we do have information that allows us to synthesize and provide a more restricted EFH boundary for most of our species and life stages. These two alternatives were considered too broad in our view. In addition to amending EFH, we are proposing habitat area of particular concern. HAPCs are based on one or more of the following considerations: the importance of the ecological function provided by the habitat, the extent to which the habitat is sensitive to human-induced environmental degradation, whether and to what extent development activities are or will be stressing the habitat type, and the rarity of the habitat type. These are all defined in the EFH regulations that I discussed at the outset. For alternative one, for HAPCs, is obviously in the no-action alternative, we would maintain the current HAPCs. Alternative two, which is our preferred alternative, would designate an HAPC for spawning bluefin tuna in the Gulf of Mexico while maintaining the current HAPCs. We based the alternative, which I'll show you in a map, on a number of different data sources, including the NIMS Southeast Fishery Science Center larval surveys for bluefin tuna, University of Southern Mississippi larval surveys, Pelagic Observer Program, Cooperative Tagging Center, and Billfish Foundation data. They were actually very helpful in providing data, and they worked closely with Miami CTC in providing their volunteer-collected data to NIMS. And then we also received a written request from the NCMC, National Center for Marine Conservation, and Tag a Giant Foundation to consider this area in the Gulf of Mexico as an HAPC. So this is the area you see in light blue. It's overlaying on the current EFH boundary for bluefin tuna spawning and larval areas in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's a refinement of the current EFH designation for bluefin tuna larval spawning areas and eggs in the Gulf of Mexico. The area is based in large part on some published work from Dr. Barbara Block. Here I've laid over some of the data points from the various data sources that we relied on to consider this area. In green you see, in dark green, you see the Pelagic Observer Program data of adult bluefin tuna caught in the Gulf of Mexico. In lighter green, in the larger circles, you see some of the NIMS Southeast Center larval survey data that you can see is located on a grid throughout the Gulf of Mexico. In red, you see the University of Southern Mississippi larval data toes that they've collected over the years. And then finally, the big bullseye object in the lower left-hand corner is recent research done by Stephen Teo et al., who has been working with Dr. Barbara Block and Andre Bustani to further delineate bluefin tuna spawning habitat in the Gulf of Mexico. And that area shows, is our rendition, actually. We geo-referenced some of the information from their paper, so this isn't direct data from them. We wanted to see the relationship between the area that they've identified recently as being what they're considering a high likelihood of breeding phase bluefin tuna occurring. That would be in the red center within larger concentric rings growing around that, depending on the likelihood of bluefin tuna spawning occurring in that area. And as you'll see from that figure, a large portion of that does occur outside of the EEZ. The southern boundary of our HAPC coincides with the boundary of the EEZ. Again, we can't designate EFH outside U.S. waters. But we wanted to see what that area that they've recently delineated, that was published in 2007, how it overlapped and coincided with the area that we're considering. Taking all of these data sources into account, you can see that there's a lot going on in the Gulf of Mexico. There obviously is a widespread use of the Gulf of Mexico for bluefin tuna spawning. So rather than go with a very focused, small area, we decided to be inclusive and take the broader approach in terms of the delineation of this HAPC. We considered two other alternatives for designating HAPC for bluefin tuna in the Gulf of Mexico. You can see there's obviously a lot of interest and focus on bluefin tuna right now because of the status of the stock. A lot of interest in the Gulf of Mexico because that is the known spawning area for western bluefin tuna. So alternative three would have designated an HAPC based on the 95% probability boundary for bluefin tuna larval data collections. We ran that analysis. It's on the EFH mapping site that I showed you. It tends to be very disjointed when you run the probability boundary on that data and not as all-inclusive as we would have wanted it to be. So for that reason, we didn't prefer that alternative. And similar approach with alternative four based on the 95% probability boundary for adult bluefin tuna, which are largely breeding phase spawning bluefin in the Gulf of Mexico. Similar concern as alternative three that it tends to be a smaller area, not as inclusive, and did not include all of the data sets and as broad of an area as we had hoped to designate the HAPC in. In terms of fishing impacts on EFH, the process requires us to evaluate potential adverse effect on fishing activities on HMS and non-HMS EFH, and to minimize adverse effects from fishing on EFH to the extent practicable. In the consolidated FMP, we did a thorough gear analysis and made a determination that most HMS gears, which are fished in the water column, are not having an effect on EFH. The lone exception at this point we consider to be bottom longline gear. So in the consolidated FMP, we said that we would take another look at some of the potential effects of bottom longline gear, which is used almost exclusively in the shark bottom longline fishery, to see if there were any effects, and in particular to just determine the degree of overlap of shark bottom longline fishing effort on some of the EFH areas that have been identified, for instance, in the Gulf of Mexico and the South Atlantic. So here you see, zeroed in on that portion of the Florida Keys and the Gulf of Mexico, shark bottom longline observed sets with a start and end point connected by a line. And this analysis was to determine the degree of overlap between the sets and some of the coral reef areas in the Keys, which is one of the key areas where there are vertical structures that could potentially be affected by bottom longline gear. And if we looked at this, as we looked at this in more detail, we noticed a pattern of the fishermen actually not fishing on the reefs. They tended to fish on sand and mud bottom adjacent to the reefs. This has been our understanding from many years of observing this fishery and anecdotal information and speaking to fishermen, that particularly if fishing with monofilament gear, they wouldn't want to necessarily set their gear in coral reefs where they could risk losing or damaging that gear. So in the over 10 years of shark bottom longline observer data that was put into this analysis, over 1,500 sets that have been observed over those years, we found only 17 sets that had intersected with coral reef areas in the Florida Keys. And expanding that outward, we determined that the number of potential sets based on historic fishing effort would have ranged somewhere between 26 to 78 sets per year on the coral reef areas. But in addition to that, we recently published an amendment to our consolidated FMP, amending our shark management measures, as many of you may know. And in that amendment, we severely cut back and restricted fishing effort to the point where most of the directed fishery now is under the auspices of our shark research fishery program. So the number and effort of fishing vessels has decreased considerably since historic times and upon which we had based this analysis. So taking all of those thoughts into consideration, we did not consider that bottom longline gear was having a negative effect on EFH. There were some other areas that we looked at as well that had been considered EFH by the Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council, and looked at the overlap between shark bottom longline fishing effort in some of those areas along the Florida coast, Panhandle, Apalachicola Bay area, and even their analysis determined in their EFH amendment that their gears were not having an effect on EFH. So they developed a very in-depth indexing system for determining the level of fishing effects on various habitats that they manage. So in addition, we did not determine that any other fishing gears were having a negative effect on HMS EFH. And the effects of bottom longline gear and other bottom tending gears on EFH are considered minimal and temporary at this time. Therefore, we're not proposing any new management measures. In addition to fishing impacts, there are non-fishing impacts that obviously come into play on essential fish habitat. We analyze these thoroughly in the consolidated FMP. They include a host of different activities that are listed here. We didn't revisit all of these, but there are two new ones at the bottom of the list that we did look at in a little more detail because they are looming on the horizon. Those are oil and gas exploration and development, obviously, with the lifting of the ban on OCS oil development. This has the potential to become a much bigger issue. There are also the renewable energy projects, as Dave mentioned earlier. There was an FR notice published recently, in the last year, by the Mineral Management Service proposing data collection and technology testing at five different sites along the Atlantic coast, including New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Georgia, and Florida, looking at a variety of different renewable energy development types, such as wind, tidal, and even down in the Florida Straits, I believe that's a current project. So this is something we need to keep our eyes on. They're actually consulting with NMFS right now on these projects. There's no development taking place yet, but they're simply soliciting proposals on collecting additional information and trying to figure out whether it's feasible to move forward with some of these projects. In terms of the oil and gas development, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, this has the potential to affect EFH. And what you see here on this figure are the current oil platform locations in the Gulf of Mexico overlaid on the essential fish habitat and HAPC boundary that we're proposing, just to give you a sense of where these oil platforms occur. And I've also included in there the red 300-meter contour line. That's of interest because there's a greater and greater effort to expand into the deep sea drilling areas beyond that red line. And in fact, currently 72% of production in the Gulf of Mexico is from wells greater than 300 meters. So obviously there's going to be a lot of interest in developing these areas. Luckily, we do have under the EFH provisions the ability to consult with companies that are proposing these projects. We have consulted in the past, are currently consulting on some liquefied natural gas projects, and the intent obviously there would be to try and minimize any direct or indirect effects that some of these development activities might be having on all EFH, but also in particular on bluefin tuna spawning areas in the Gulf of Mexico. Finally, again, looking at some of the lease sites, these are in green are the current active leases, perhaps not in development, but ones that are available to be developed. And it shows you, again, the focus and interest in getting further and further out in the Gulf of Mexico. This figure is as of July of this year. I guess in closing, I'd just like to say that the real strengths, I believe, of the EFH provisions are the oversight that NOAA has for any type, both fishing and non-fishing impact activities that might have an effect on EFH. It allows us a foot in the door to be able to consult with the companies or developers or projects and provide conservation and management recommendations. Unfortunately, they're not binding, but it does allow us to push companies in the direction that we need them to go to minimize impacts on EFH. Here's just a list of the public hearings that we have scheduled for our draft EFH amendment. There's really only one more that we need to consult with. That's the South Atlantic Council. As I mentioned, we'll have a public hearing in here tonight in which I'll be hoping to go through the online mapping program in much greater detail and can show some of the data, and I think it's a very fun interactive session. And then finally, if anyone does have comments, either written or if you'd like to discuss something with me, you can please contact me at the number that's here. You can also email us. We have a special site set up to take public comments on our EFH amendment. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. I'm wondering about the HAPC map for Atlantic bluefin tuna. I'm looking at the one on, I don't see a page number, but it's on with all the data points. And the HAPC block that goes to the north comes within practically touching the outer part of the delta on the south part of Louisiana. And I don't see much in the way of data points on the west side there. And I'm concerned. I'm wondering about the this line that comes so close to land. It seems to me that's based on just larval data. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's being designated HAPC for spawning habitat. And I don't know. This is really a question. It's not a criticism because I don't know what the currents are there. Is it possible that you've got an area where, particularly off of the tip there, where larva is being swept in there that probably is not going to be viable and may not, in fact, be contributing to the population?
That could very well be. And we have received a number of comments on this area, and We're going to be taking another look at that and very likely be amending that northern boundary to follow one of the contour lines that comes further offshore. So I agree with your point. I think it's a concern that others have raised, especially on our HMS AP, and we will be making some revisions to this current boundary.
Okay. One other question is on the TO data. I note that has on the northern part of that circle, there's the yellow area that says breeding phase low is an area that you also have a high number of data points for your larva toes, actually from both of the other studies. Is that TO data based upon larva, or is it based upon adult breeding activity?
They did some tagging work with adult bluefin tuna and did some very in-depth analyses of dive profiles and correlations with both bathymetric characteristics as well as ocean height, chlorophyll concentrations, that sort of thing. But that was clearly the area that they seemed to focus on, yeah. So it came as a surprise to us.
And one last question. The use of larval data as a proxy for adult breeding activity, that's been determined by you folks to be the best way to go in outlining HAPC?
I think what we're trying to do is look at all the different life history stages, not just one in isolation. That's why we did show the adult bluefin tuna points on here as well.
I see.
So
okay,
I wouldn't say exclusively larval data, no.
Anyone else? Dave Gaethel?
Yeah, I had a question about both the EFH boundaries and the HAPC boundaries. Are they only within the U.S. EEZ, or are you designating waters in other countries?
No, we're not. It's only within U.S. EEZ. That's according to the regulations. We don't have jurisdiction outside the EEZ to establish EFH boundaries.
Okay, because the reason I was asking, I was looking at that yellowfin one, and it looks like some of the waters are in the Bahamas. Is that just kind of misprinted, or?
I'd have to take another look. One thing, as I mentioned when I was describing our mapping site, is that we took all data into account, both data inside and outside the EEZ for those species, for instance, which one, yellowfin tuna, that might occur outside the EEZ, mapped the 95% probability boundary based on all the data points, but then clipped it along the EEZ. So if you're seeing a preferred alternative that has an EFH designation outside the EEZ, then that probably needs to be corrected because it shouldn't be.
Okay, I think that's exactly what it is. I think it's the 95% probability across the range, and it's not cropped for the U.S. EEZ. That's why I was curious. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay. And as you've mentioned throughout your presentation, at 7 p.m. tonight, you'll have a public hearing on Draft Amendment 1?
Yes, and it'll be in here.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we're a little ahead of the schedule today. We'll move on to open period.